Super. Well, first of all, as always, thanks for the opportunity to visit with you guys, and this probably won't be the last time. At least I hope it's not the last time before November, for sure, and then hopefully many times thereafter. I just want to just let you know kind of where we're at, and then you guys can fire away if that's appropriate.
That sounds
great. You know, we'll be going back here in 10 days or so. The biggest issue that's out there, the same biggest issue that was out there last year, and that's jobs, and how do we create jobs, and how do we facilitate the private sector to create jobs. We'll be looking for opportunities. I carried and sponsored the only jobs bill that passed last year. That was the Vow to Hire Heroes Act that really addresses some of the challenges that are out there for our veterans, particularly those returning from Iraq and Afghanistan in the job sector. And you guys know the statistics on it. Their unemployment rate's about double everybody else. Deficit and debt's still going to be there and should be still there to not only talk about. Hopefully we can come up with a big proposal. When I was here last time, I'm sure I talked about Simpson-Bowles and the work of that commission, plus the work of the Gang of Six, plus the work of the Biden committee, plus the work of the super committee. I'm discouraged we didn't come up with something that was sizable and real and I should say significant and real and a way to move forward. But you know, there's going to be a lot of pressure over the next year put on by people, and I think I certainly heard it as I've gone around the state the last couple of weeks, and I've been all over the state the last couple of weeks having meetings with folks, and I think that using those different groups work in a foundational effort, and I know I'm working with folks right now to come up with a proposal. Hopefully in the Senate we need 60 votes, and we can put away the partisanship and get something done that's gonna help move our economy forward in a way in the short and long term. So we've got that. That's basically it. Just over the last 2 weeks, I've had the opportunity to be in Missoula, Kalispell, Great Falls, Helena, here and down in Billings, and Bozeman here. We've had a chance to talk to a lot of different folks. Last week, we had some Facebook folks in on parental and student education of social media sites. It was very, very good. We had some great forums around that. Very, very well. Very well attended. Yesterday, we had Holly Petraeus, who's basically in charge of helping servicemen deal with financial difficulties that they have through the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She just did a great job. We had, a solid jam-packed day of meetings with guardsmen and airmen and leadership from both the Air Force and the Guard, talking to about services that are offered and how we can help their airmen and help basically the services there and do a better job with that community leaders. It was real good sessions. Other than that, I think we're pretty good. You guys can go ahead, rock and roll.
Could you refresh our memory? The super committee failed to come up with a plan.
Yeah, I think it was $1.2 trillion. I believe that's what it was, yes.
Okay, but they that having happened, wasn't it written into the legislation that there's going to be automatic cuts this coming December?
Yeah, January 2013, I believe.
And what do they call that? Sequestration.
Sequestration, yes.
Is that going to happen?
If we don't do anything, it's going to happen. Absolutely. No,
and
I think
and you're
that.
Confident that the
I think Congress is going to do something. It may be at the 11th hour Congress does something because they tend to push against the wall before they do stuff. But I honestly do think something will be done. And here's so you know, I mean, Bill, my concern is that it's significant. There's a reason why. The reason it needs to be significant is, number one, it needs to be significant to get our arms around the problem. But number two, I think it's much easier to sell to the people in the Senate and to the people back home if it is significant and is pretty broad-based. I've said from the beginning, everything needs to be on the table, and I mean that. We don't get through this thing. We don't get to a significant debt reduction package without everything being on the table. And I've had Montanans in my office and back home here, talk about the fact that they don't mind feeling some pain as long as they're the ones, as long as they're not the only ones that feel all the pain. You know what I mean? As long as they're the ones that don't feel all the pain. So I think that you get a significant package, it's much easier to get through the process. And I think it's better for the economy.
By significant, you mean something
big,
more?
4 to 5 trillion. Yeah.
Oh, 4 to 5 trillion?
Yeah.
Do you think that's possible?
Yeah.
Which is on the order of what the
Simpson Bowles, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You see that that's the proposal on the table that has the most chance of moving
forward? At this point in time, there's not a proposal on the table. That's one of the proposals that's been on the table over the last year, and it's the one that I think was the best thought out.
What portion of that did you like the best?
I think the fact that it took into consideration everything. I think the fact that, and by the way, there's plenty in it I don't like, just so you know.
Yeah.
But the fact is that it was broad-based enough where I could literally say, you know, I don't particularly like what they did here or here, but this over here was something that I've advocated for a long time. And so, and I think that's what it needs to be. And the specifics, well, the specifics, by the way, are very, very important as we go down. You know, putting the faces behind the programs are really important. I mean, we don't want to do things that put our economy in a disadvantage as we're moving forward. But by the same token, I think if we're realistic about this, use some common sense, and put the kind of partisanship that happened at Christmas time over in the House, where we sent a bill over with 89 votes and the party bosses, for whatever reason, and I'm not going to justify that, say, oh, we're not going to pass this. And then it's just the craziness that's gone on this last year is just exactly that. It's crazy. And folks need to be held accountable for it. And I think that as long as that craziness exists, we're not going to get things done that need to be done, like highway bill, flood insurance bill, debt reduction proposals that address us in the short and the long term. And the folks that want, I mean, the sequestration that this proposal that Bill talked about, and sorry if I'm talking too much, is exactly the wrong way to go about this, by the way. I mean, to walk in and say we're going to cut 5 or 10 or 15 or 20% across the board is let's have a computer do it. The fact is you need to look at programs, determine which ones work, support the ones that work, take the fat out of the ones that need the fat taken out, and eliminate the ones that don't work. And that's easier to talk about than it is to do, but we can do it. We just need to be resolved to do it and do it.
Makes me a little pessimistic to what you just said and how crazy things are in Washington. The perception from the outside is that the president gets behind, the Republicans are going to oppose it until they kill him. That seems to be what's going on. What's going to change between now and January that would get both parties behind a $4 to $5 trillion deficit reduction?
Yeah, I think, well, in the Senate there's been 40, maybe a few more actually, pretty much evenly split Democrats. Republicans have been talking about this for well over a year now. I think that conversation is a healthy conversation to have, and there's people on both sides of the aisle, myself included, that are pushing to try to get something big and long-term. I think the longer we're able to synthesize this and talk about it, I just think the better chance it has of happening. I just do, Bill. You know, the country's been around for 230-some years now. It isn't here because we've had gridlock the whole time. It has ebbed and flowed in our history. We're in a period of obstructionism. No ifs, ands, or buts about that. But I'm optimistic it's going to change, and I think the more we can talk to folks that are willing to talk about common sense solutions, and they exist on both sides of the aisle, the better off we are. The longer we can have partisanship, Trump citizenship, which is what's going on right now back there, then we're going to continue to be where we're at. But it's my hope that the more we talk, the more we synthesize through all this, the more we understand that you can't do this just by dealing with discretionary spending. It's not logical nor possible. The more we'll come to a conclusion that works for the American people. Trust me, looking from the outside in, what you see is what you are getting. I mean, it's pretty clear what's going on. And you are correct in everything that you said earlier. I just am hopes that when more people talk, the more trust that can be built. But as long as politics is trumping the whole policy issue. But people are getting sick of it, and I'm getting sick of it, and have been sick of it for a while.
Senator, we had Representative Rebert here last week. I think maybe Sonny, you asked this question of that the...
You can't be taking Sonny's question.
I'm not sure which question you're
referring to. Well, I think that what you were getting at is that a lot of folks, I mean, if you see the polls, feel that Congress is a dysfunctional place right now.
They polled me, I'd say it was too.
And Representative Rebert, his answer to that question was, well, it's the sausage is being made like it always has been. It's just that there's more of an awareness, more of a 24-hour news cycle that's catching up with this type of thing. Do you think that's accurate, or do you think that this is a new era?
I think we got a lot of folks back there that like to sit on the sidelines and throw stones. I think we got a lot of folks back there that are obstructionists. I think we got a lot of folks back there that are working for the party and not the people. I think it's seriously broken, and it's not broken because we've got a 24-hour news cycle. It's broken because we've got people out there that think they win politically by being obstructionists.
How big of a factor is the Tea Party right now in Congress?
In the Senate, it's not. I don't know about the House.
I mean, that seems like there seems to be more reasonable people in the Senate.
Thank you.
Enough reasonable people that, yeah, they can reach an agreement, just like they did in December. But then it hits the House, and there's this block of votes. You couldn't understand what the House leadership did. I just watching it on TV. I thought he doesn't have the votes to pass this thing, so he's not gonna put it up for a vote. John Boehner, and I'm assuming he was counting votes. I don't know.
Well, I would assume somebody's gonna be counting votes.
Yeah. So why else would he have done that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I wanted a year-long extension, too. I want more predictability in government. We just came back from the Contractors Association meeting down in Big Sky, and that's absolutely unequivocally, I think, what most people in business, most, I don't know, education, whatever it might be, most parents want, working families. But we're doing things like two-month extension, that's fine. Here's the part that's frustrating, Bill. The year-long extension that was blocked in the Senate was blocked by the Republican minority leader. So we had to sit down and negotiate, and we negotiated a two-month extension. Now, I didn't like it, but it was better than nothing. And, you know, we'll have this debate again the end of February, and I that's the way it is. But you can't get ping-pong back and forth. I mean, so we sent a two-month back because the minority leader wouldn't let a month one come in, a year-long one come in, and then they don't pass it, and it's a tax increase on working families, Keystone Pipeline. It's a vote against the Keystone Pipeline. I'm always believing. And by the way, there's plenty of folks back on both sides of the aisle say you don't take the vote if you don't have the votes. I say take the vote. Take the vote, hold people accountable for the vote. Well, they took the vote, and the vote was no. And they were told to vote no. And they voted no. I mean, I don't know how the House works, and I don't expect, folks to understand how either body works, but it just doesn't make any sense to me and what's transpired over there on that particular issue. But I think what it is it's a perfect sign of what's wrong with Washington, D.C.
You mentioned the Keystone Pipeline. Where are we at on that?
Well, I think the president has till the 21st of February to approve that pipeline.
And, so that it's tied to the two-month extension somehow.
It's tied.
He has to make a decision in order to extend the middle class.
No, the tax break runs out at the end of February too. We've got to address that in a proactive way if it's going to continue.
Right.
And then he is given a charge to approve that pipeline within that time period that ends at February 21st. So he's got to make a decision between now and February
21. You think he's going to?
Yeah.
Approve it.
I do, but I'm not on the inside track of what the administration's doing. But yeah, I think I hope he does.
Do you have any objections to it?
Just that it's done right. It's got to be built right because oil spills don't help anybody and ruins water supplies and things like that. And I don't think the pipeline company or any of the companies that are involved with that Keystone Pipeline want oil spills either. So it's got to be built correctly and safely, and And then we got provision in on private property rights, which I think is very, very, very important. You have to negotiate in good faith with these property owners. If you don't, I don't want to act a Congress allowing a company to run over private property owners. That's not right. Those are my two concerns: is the safety, mainly for the sake of potable water, and then the other one is make sure you don't. But yeah, absolutely. I would rather do business with Canada than I would with Saudi Arabia.
There's not going to be many Montana jobs associated with that pipeline.
Oh, it just depends. I mean, I know last week I had a forum in Billings, and there was a couple hundred people there, and the reporter in Billings said that there was a study that came out of the university, and I don't remember the university off the top of my head, but you guys are familiar with it, I'm sure, that said that the jobs weren't going to be near what they claimed. I don't know. What I do know is that there's going to take some people to build that pipeline. The people that are in the industry, the welders and the pipe fitters and those kind of folks, think that it's going to create a lot of good jobs for them, and I think that's a positive step. After it's done, there's going to be a great tax base along that for those counties that pipeline runs through. I think that's positive. I think the fact that it takes pressure off of the Middle East, it's a very unpredictable place, I think that's positive. I'm still a big supporter of renewable energy. I think we need to do what we can do to push renewable energy along. I think that also creates jobs in Montana. I think it's kind of, get as many slices of the pie as you can to make this country have as many steps towards energy independence as it can. Now, this pipeline is not energy independence. It's Canadian oil, but I'd still rather do business with a friend like Canada than I would with a country in the Middle East that, as the governor would say, takes that money and used to buy bullets to shoot us.
Last week when Representative Weaver was here, he said that your forest jobs and recreation bill was a wilderness bill that only guarantees wilderness and doesn't guarantee jobs or recreation. So what's your response to that?
He needs to read the bill. The fact is that that bill was a well-crafted bill, and as long as we're talking about how dysfunctional Washington, D.C. is, they could learn a lot from what went into this wilderness bill. Jobs bill, recreation bill, you can call it all of the above, because it is all of the above. It's going to put some folks to work with chainsaws in the woods. It's going to give mills a sustainable supply of timber. It's going to open up some opportunities, I think, for biomass facilities in the forest. I think it's going to open up opportunities for recreation and hunting and fishing and clean water and all sorts of stuff, because the bill is far more than just one thing. It's far more than that. Now, he will tell you also that, because I've heard him say it, that, oh, it's just, let's go back to the old trigger language of the timber wars of the 1970s. Nobody has won for 30 years. This was a bill that was crafted by people who set their guns down and came at a table like this and visited. It was a group of people that encouraged as many people as possible to come in the process. And by the way, the ones that didn't come in the process didn't want to be a part of the process. And what they came up with in three different regions of the state was a way to manage our forest better. And if the mill owners of the state, the Sherm Andersons and the Dan Daly's and Lauren Roses and a list of myriad of other mill owners in the state think this is good for sustaining and creating jobs in their business, I think that it's a positive thing. And it shows one more thing. It shows about the congressman, quite frankly, because he did his level best to try to stop this. He's more concerned about his job than he is the jobs of the people of Montana. And maybe I should look at the camera when I say that.
Another question I have was about the Highlight Porcupine Buffalo Horn Wilderness Study Area, which is an important issue to people here in Bozeman.
Yeah.
I was wondering,
could you say that again three times really fast?
It took me a long time to get that down. But I was just wondering, in your opinion, what would it take to inspire congressional action on that?
There's not been a wilderness designation in 30 years, and I will tell you the only reason that these designations are on the table is because it's been an on-the-ground effort. It's been a ground-up, not a top-down effort. That model is a good model, and I think that you get on-the-ground support. I don't care what the policy is. That's a very positive thing, but it's critically important. It is critically important with any sort of land use designations.
What do you think the status is of your jobs and recreation bill? Is
Well, I mean, I think we're going to continue. It is a bill that is pretty Montana-centric. I mean, not pretty. It is Montana-centric. And to get time on the floor for it alone isn't going to happen. We knew that when we introduced it. We had a great hearing last year. The opponent of the bill actually turned out to be probably as good a proponent as our proponent for the bill. It is very, 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 very much... it's something that people of the state of Montana want as they go around the state. It polls very, very well. Not that that's a big thing, but it's got solid support, and I think that we're going to look for opportunities to amend it going forth, and hopefully we can get a good piece of policy passed for the right reasons, and that is going to create jobs. If folks want to play politics with it, they can, and politics can trump policy once again, which is what's wrong with Washington, D.C. But the fact is, it's about jobs, and I am confident. I am confident, as confident as I was with the Wolf legislation, that sure, are the people going to sue? Yeah, they're going to sue. People sue all the time. But they failed on Wolves, and they'll fail on this. And that's why the far left, as with the far right, is opposed to this bill. People in the middle support.
You may have already addressed this when you said something about trigger language, but Representative Reberg said that he could compromise on the bill if for every so many tens of thousands of acres, I guess, not board feet, though.
That's the trigger language.
That's trigger language.
You call it release language, trigger language. That's what it is. And that's by the way, why our forests have lost for 30 years, is because that fight has been going on. And why it won't work, I can't get to the Senate, number one. Number two, this is an agreement that was negotiated on the ground, and quite honestly, the folks in the timber industry understand that that's a poison pill, so to speak. The other thing that's important to note is Representative Reberg was given an opportunity to carry this bill and make those changes, and he chose not to. He chose to set them sidelines and throw stones.
Is there any guarantee in the bill that the timber will be offered for harvest?
Yeah, it's first of all, it's very carefully written, number one. Number two, it's an act of Congress. And it's solid, solid language. And it is why, as I said earlier, that the far left doesn't like it. Because it's going to require some folks to do some management to forests, the Forest Service to do some management for it. Now, why is this important? Now, really, let's look at this. Take a look at Colorado. I mean, first of all, we got dead trees. You guys know that. Take a look at Colorado. Their timber infrastructure is gone. Now it's on the hook of the taxpayers to take care of those forests, to manage those forests entirely. No jobs. It's all taxpayer. We haven't got the timber infrastructure that we had 30 years ago, but we still have a decent timber infrastructure. We still got mills. We still got people with chainsaws and trucks, and there's demand. I mean, there's demand for the lumber out there. And so now is the time. We've got unemployment in the West that's particularly, western Montana, that's particularly high. And it's time we start taking some proactive steps to fix it. And we ought to start looking for ways to create jobs, not looking for ways to stop them. So, yeah, it's rock solid. But are they going to sue? Sure. They're going to lose, too.
So speaking of jobs,
yes.
The solution that we heard last week was if you cut the deficit, that will give confidence to business owners and they will begin hiring and that will solve the jobs problem. Is that a good solution? And sort of a similar question, I guess my concern with that solution is if you cut the deficit a lot, really, really fast, that'll cut government jobs and that could actually cause the problem to grow. So how would you handle the jobs problem?
Well, I think it's multifaceted. That's pretty simplified. It's much more complicated than that. I think there's several things. I think the debt and deficit discussions have to go on. We have to come up with a real significant plan, as I said earlier, to cut the deficit and debt. We've got to take into consideration where the economy is right now and where the economy we can anticipate going forward, because you're exactly right. And we also have to look at what we're investing in. You want to cut the legs out from education, Pell Grants, whatever you want to do. Long term, that's going to have some pretty negative impacts. And same thing with R&D, same thing with infrastructure. So let's take a look at that component, and let's look at where we can cut by putting everything on the table, because there are things we can cut. I've got a foreign base, for example. I've got a foreign base bill. We had facilities from the Cold War that quite frankly we don't need anymore. And let's use a BRAC process on them, a let's use the process to analyze them. And by the way, we got some language in this last bill that'll do that. And then predictability, I think, is also very, very important. I think that the fact that we've had, you know, in the Senate, there's been judges come up, they've been filibustered for a few days, and then we have a vote and one person votes against us. Sometimes nobody votes against them, just to muck up the process. That is just a sign of the unpredictability and the short-term sight of this Congress, and I think that that's that needs to be fixed. I think that could do a lot of positive things. I think that the regulation on community banks has a real negative impact on and they need regulation, and they'll tell you they need regulation, but I think the pendulum swung too far after the meltdown. At the end of Bush's term, it just swung too far. I mean, Paulson came in and said it wasn't the fact there was a lack of regulation on Wall Street; it was that there was none, and that's really where the focus needs to remain, and not on these small banks and credit unions that really are so vital to the economy in rural America, and I think vital to urban America too. I just think those are the things I take into consideration as you move forward. I think that you walk in and just say, we're gonna end early childhood education. We're gonna end Pell Grants. And we're gonna end Job Corps. And we're gonna end all these things that give our young people opportunity. That's gonna have some pretty serious impacts in the future. Now, like I said, there are a lot of other things. There are a lot of things out there that are gonna be painful too. Take a look at the farm program and those proposals. There's gonna be some pain inflicted there. But I think that those things in a big package are reasonable.
You used the number 5 to 6 trillion earlier, I think.
Yeah, 4 to 5, 6. Yeah, somewhere near.
My understanding is the only way you get there is either by cutting entitlement programs or higher taxes or both.
I think you've got to. I think everything has to be on the table. I think military spending has to be on the table, entitlements, revenue, even discretionary, everything. Everything. I don't think you get your arms around the deficit and debt unless you go big, and you don't get your arms around the debt. You aren't able to go big unless you consider everything.
So if you were omnipotent, how would you do it? I mean, if you were in complete control, would it be mostly through taxes or more?
No, I wouldn't. It would be. It would. I don't think it would be mostly through taxes. I think that the proposal, if you take, and I can't remember what Simpson Bowles had. Was it 2-to-1 or 3-to-1? Somewhere in there. I think in that range is appropriate.
But it cuts to revenue.
Yeah, I'm more on the cut side than the revenue side, but. You know, it may end up being 1-to-1 too. I mean, the fact is, it has to be. You got to come down and take a look at the programs. And the tax code, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's full of tax earmarks. It's way too complicated. And there are some proposals out there that can simplify that tax code in a big way, increase revenue, and actually take rates down across the board. So, but you can't have a tax code. And this also came out of Simpson Bowles, where your income tax loses $100 billion a year. I mean, you've got more in tax earmarks than you're taking in. I mean, that's not really good. So there's opportunity to do some stuff. But as far as the percentage, I just have to take a look at the programs and then go from there.
Would you envision something like, if you cut into entitlements, Social Security, do you envision increasing or raising the retirement age?
There's several proposals out there. There's proposals around mean testing. There's proposals around raising the retirement age. There's proposals around taking the cap off. And there may be other proposals, too. I think you put everything on the table and you figure out what you can make work and what best. Look, Social Security has been a great safety net for our seniors. And it's something that folks have depended on in a lifetime. It's a program that's worked pretty darn well for the last 70 years plus. And it's something we need to keep in mind as we move forward. We need to make it stronger for future generations. I think that's what's really critically important. But let's put everything on the table and let's hammer it out. Let's compromise. Let's do it. Let's not draw lines in the sand and say you cross this line and I'm taking my toys and going home. Let's work together and get it done. That's what the American people want to see happen, and I think that's what more and more people in Congress want to see happen too.
The markets would love it.
I think the markets would love it, and yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's, you know, a lot of folks have signed pledges that says you can do this, you can't do that, and it's not healthy.
Question about this year.
Yeah.
You've got a big year ahead of you. And you've got a formidable opponent. Can you talk a little bit about how you'd like to see the campaign go? Negative campaigning, what the role is, your willingness to accept money from out of state. Can you talk just in general about this?
Well, what I'd like to see is a campaign that's based on fact, not fiction, based on our records. And that's what I'd like to see. Let's have an honest comparison of what who's got done. Who's rolled up their sleeves and went to work, and who sat on the sidelines.
And what's your strategy for campaigning should it get negative?
I don't know that there's much I can do about it. We just got to do the best we can do to get our message out, which is what we've accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it. There's going to be more money. It's already seen over $1 million spent in the state by out-of-state folks. It's not talking about anything other than trying to rip me down. And that's going to continue. That's the nature of the field that we're on right now. And we've been around this state. I've come home every weekend for the last 5 years talking to folks about issues and taking their ideas back to Washington, D.C. We've worked hard. And we've done a hell of a good job representing Montana. And we're going to continue to work hard for this next year. And we're going to push this campaign back as far as we can so we can continue to focus on policy. But make no mistake about it, I'm fully aware of the fact that there's a lot of out-of-state interest and maybe even out-of-country interest. They're going to, which is highly illegal, by the way, which are going to be putting money into third-party folks that are going to be trying to get me out of office. And I'd like to see it remain Montana-centric, but that's probably not the way it's going to be. But all we can do is talk the facts. I'm not wired to lie. And I might get statistics wrong or mix up figures. But the fact is all I want to do is get the information out on what we've accomplished and what he's accomplished. And I'm going to tell you, there is a big difference.
So what happens if and when it turns negative?
It already has turned negative.
Mm-hmm. Could get worse. Especially in those last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Will you respond in kind?
We're going to be focused on positive with our money, on what I've done, what we've accomplished. And I think a comparison of record is positive, too, by the way. But no, they're look, for the camera, two fingers. Okay. My name's spelled J-O-N, you know. I mean, talk about craziness. It's already happening. And they don't care about the facts. The facts are second nature. Second fiddle. Why? Because they can't beat me if we stick with the facts. We stick with the facts, I win this election going away. If fiction trumps fact, then it becomes a jump ball.
Will there be any out-of-state money coming in on your behalf?
Look, we raised in 06 about $1 million in-state, and that was a record, and we're hoping to raise that again and maybe a lot more than that. We'll raise as much as we can. As far as the third party stuff, I don't know.
I mean, like a super PAC kind of.
Yeah, I don't.
Advertising.
I've been waiting. One of these days. Maybe. I don't know. And I don't know what they're going to say. And it's pretty crazy. But I do know that, Representative Reberg's friends have played in this. We got one of them pulled off the air because it was so bad and blatantly false.
Which event is that?
It was one on farm dust. These guys don't believe I still farm. I do. We still run the tractor. We still run the combine. We still plant the seeds, my wife and I. And, they put out crazy stuff like tester supports. EPA's control of farm dust is crazy. I know agriculture, and it's part of the business.
It's dusty.
It's dusty.
What's the next debt ceiling fight coming up?
That's probably part of the 21st battle.
21st of this month?
No, the debt ceiling. Oh, man, I can't remember. It's probably... I don't know, Bill. I'd have to go back and check and see.
It's coming right up, isn't it?
I think it is coming right up.
Is it going to be another circus like the last
time? I hope not. I really hope not. I mean, you got folks that are willing to put the country into a depression and default. It's not healthy. It's not responsible.
A little time on the debt ceiling until next year.
Till next year? Okay. So it's through this year? Okay.
Oh, the debt ceiling is good through this year?
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, I thought it was coming up in the next
year. I thought it was too, actually.
Check.
Yeah, we'll check it. We'll check it, though.
What about health care reform?
Yeah. what do you want to know? I mean, it's being implemented as we speak. I think the fact that there's 2.5 million children that have health insurance now that didn't before it was passed. I think the fact that we're seeing insurance companies held accountable. I think the fact that we're seeing pre-existing conditions and lifetime caps being taken off, pre-existing conditions in a staggered sort of way. I think. Those are positive things as we move forward, and I think that if you take a look back at the previous system and the number of people who were uninsured, of which I was one at one point in time in my life, and walking across the yard without insurance, and it was when I was in my late 20s, you get a pain in your back and you hope it's not cancer. I mean, all this stuff, we were in a system where if you got sick, you could get thrown off the policy. If you get sick, you lose your farm or your small business. Look, we made some advancements, I think, with that policy. There's been some changes to it already. There will be changes to the healthcare policy in years to come to try to make it better. And then, at some point in time, it'll get fully implemented over the next 3 or 4 years, and we'll see if the competition happens in the exchange like was intended, and move forth. But one thing is for certain: the system that we were in and still are in to a good portion was broken, and broken badly, and we had far too many uninsured folks that we were all paying for and hospitals were paying for, and it continues to be implemented, and I think the more it gets implemented, the more people will see how well it's working, and also we'll be able to see what kind of opportunities we have to make it better.
Sort of a follow-up on that. Congressman Reber told us Obamacare was going to cost $1 trillion to $2 trillion. That was inconsistent with my understanding.
Yeah.
What's your understanding?
My understanding is it's going to save money over the long haul. Some of the prevention programs are going to save money. That's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. And you move forth. I mean, it's he's an interesting cat. That's all I'm going to say. He let me give an example about figures. He walked in front of the Missoula editorial board and said, Pell Grants, I'm solid supporter. Now, he defunded them, called them 21st Century Welfare. He defunded them, walked in front of the ed board in Missoula and says, no, I'm for it. I'm trying to get the maximum out. Drives down the street to Kalispell. And then says, no, I'm against Pell Grants. I mean, it's kind of crazy. So, whatever feels good.
What do you think in your travels around the state, what do you think the majority of Montanans that you come across, are they in support of the health care changes?
Look, people are concerned with change, and I think they're still concerned about the health care bill, and they still, I don't think, understand the full ramifications of it. And I think that the more it gets implemented over the years coming up here, I think the more benefits we'll see. And I'm sure we'll see some things that need to be changed in it, too, and I think there will be an opportunity to do that. So, maybe the bigger mistake was not implementing it all right away. I mean, it's implemented in a staggered way. So, but there could be people taking advantage of that, and that's not good.
A lot of pundits are saying that the president's fate in this upcoming election is pretty tightly tied to the economy. How well the economy is.
Typically, that's been the case in previous elections.
Do you feel that your fate in this election is tied to the economy, or do you feel that your fate in this election is tied to the president?
No, I think my fate in this election is tied to how good of a job we do getting the message of what I've accomplished over the last 5-6 years. If we do a good job getting that message out, we're going to be just fine. And so far, we've been just fine.
Do you think
I think that's it more than anything. You know, I've the president's on the ballot, and I've been, it's a full ballot in Montana. I mean, it's a very, very full ballot with an open gubernatorial seat and open AG seat. But I think that, you know, we've got to focus on our work in the Senate, and that's got to be our primary focus. And then we just got to run a campaign to get the facts out. And if people know the facts, we'll be fine.
You seem to do a pretty good job of staying in touch with Montana.
Thank you.
My impression, though, is, I don't know if it's true or not, but some senators that have been in, or congressmen that have been there for 20 years, they may lose touch with where they're from. Should there be term limits for congressmen?
10 or 12 years, even, they lose track of where they're from. Hey, look, you know, there's... I actually come from a pretty good perspective on this, and I may have voted for term limits for state government. In fact, I probably did, although I don't remember casting the vote per se. When I got into the state legislature, term limits hadn't kicked in, and the old guard was still there, and then term limits kicked in over because I came in 99 session, and 2001 there was impacts, 2003, and I think by 2005, it might have been 2003 it was fully implemented, actually. It was 2003. There are some advantages to term limits. You know, new ideas are good. New energy is good. What we lost with term limits, though, was institutional memory. And gave a lot of power over to the bureaucrats and the lobbyists. The other thing that was lost was personal relationships. And I think what we've seen the last couple of years, in 09 and 11, was the latter, the personal relationships really showing how it's had some real negative impacts on. When I got there, J.D. Lynch and Tom Beck, I don't want to start dropping names, but there was a lot of guys that worked together. I mean, they've been there for a long time, over 20 years. And they worked together, and I will tell you, there was many times early on where, it's really how, why I've learned to you work with the other side, because everybody's got the same concerns. I mean, I remember early on, Mike Hallinger would talk to me about an issue, Tom Beck would talk to me about an issue, not necessarily the same issue, and they'd just sit down and say, hey, look, here's what I think, and maybe it was a form of lobbying, but the truth is, I think they were actually concerned about, you know, this particular issue, and they wanted to let me know all the facts about it. And it wasn't done for political reasons. It wasn't done to try to embarrass somebody. It wasn't done to try to make them look bad. It was done to try to help you, and I very much appreciated that. Bruce Crippen was the president of the Senate in my first session, did an incredible job. I learned an amazing amount from this guy. And I also learned an amazing amount from other people in the Senate on both sides of the aisle, because people work together. Now you just don't see that. And what I'm afraid of, as dysfunctional as Washington, D.C. is, what I would be afraid of, and by the way, I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to be there forever. I will not be there when I'm an old man. But the fact is that I think that it would add to the dysfunctionalism, and I think it would empower people who aren't elected.
Well, what's it like having been a freshman senator, and what's the prediction on what Montana would lose if we had another freshman?
Well, I mean, history will report on what that is. I mean, I think I do a pretty darn good job, and that's why I'm running again, and we'll do it again. I'll tell you, it's not nearly as glitzy as folks think it is. It's a lot of airplane travel, a lot of time away from home. If my kids were still young, I couldn't do this. No ifs, ands, or buts about that. My kids are grown, and that's what allows me to do it. I've got a chance to work with some great people within the state of Montana and back there that I wouldn't normally get a chance to work with. I've got a chance to bone up on issues that, quite frankly, I wouldn't have probably paid any attention to. It's been frustrating, but it's been good. And it's good work. We sign up for this, so this, you know, it's hard work. You roll up your sleeves, you go to work, and you're up at 6 in the morning, you go to bed at 9, 10 o'clock at night, sometimes later, and you know, my wife travels back and forth with me all the time for good reason, because we've been married for will be 35 years this year, and we want to keep it that way. And so it's important that she's there, not only so we can continue to visit around the supper table, but so that she can be a part of my life and I can be a part of hers. So it's been a very interesting experience. It's been an incredible learning curve. And you know, I think that and this is where the facts get out. I think that you just take a look at what we've got done. Him and twice as long back there than I have been. And I think that will answer your question: is what you're going to lose with him being in office versus what you have with me being in office.
Mm-hmm. Amber had a question that she sent in the email. What was it? Something about, and I'm not quite sure where she picked this up, if it was from a political ad or what, but that you had received more lobbying money than anybody else in the mm-hmm. Senate. Is that what she said in her mm-hmm. question?
Sure.
And she just wanted you to address that.
Well, I think it's the real question is about accountability. And if in fact favors are put forth for money received. And look, the first thing I did when I got there with the other members of the class of 2006 is we put forth the biggest change in how lobbyists can act since Watergate. Added transparency to the process, whether it was through earmarks or was it through activity of lobbyists, like we haven't seen for 30, 40 years. My office actually goes over and above that. We were the first to post our schedule online. And what does that mean? That means that if I'm meeting with somebody, you can get online, take a look at who I met with, and if you don't have a different perspective or the same perspective, you can call me and give me your perspective too. Because you know I just met with that person. Chances are if I'm meeting with an electrical co-op, you probably know they're going to talk about electricity and power rates and that kind of stuff. But the fact is this: we've got to raise a ton of money to get our message out, and he's already had a ton of money, over $1 million in his state spent to try to misrepresent me, and so we've got to raise a bunch of money. That being said, I haven't taken 9 luxury trips at lobbyist expense. Yes. That being said, the Western Tradition Partnership that the Supreme Court just made a decision on, upholding the 1916 law of corporations can't contribute in campaigns or third parties, I support. He's endorsed by Citizens United.
Do you think this Senate race is going to cost between you and your opponent before it's all over?
Hard to say. When Conrad and I ran against one another, it was $26 million, almost evenly split with the RSCC, DSCC, and him and I. The pros in the field have told me it's going to be somewhat more than that. And you know, I mean, there were ads run against me by third party folks before the last election was over with. There's a lot of money that's going to be spent. And probably spent on a half a dozen races.
It's
one of them. It's going to be one of them. And I'm really counting on Montana's not be able to be bought by these guys.
Has your campaign done any internal polling to see where things stand?
And we're in good shape.
Right?
Yeah.
Can we share any numbers with us?
Well, I mean, look. Here's what I'll share you. What's going to be the reality of this going forward? Yeah, I mean, we're up a bit actually, but to be honest with you, the polls are going to ebb and flow from now till election day. This is going to be a close race. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's going to be a close race. I'd love to tell you we're going to beat him by 10 points. We might beat him by 15, but that's probably unlikely. We're going to do the best we can. We're going to continue to work hard. And you know what? In the end, I'm somewhat of a fatalist on this stuff. You work hard, you do the best job you can, and it'll turn out fine. The polls are going to say what they're going to say depending on how the question's asked and who does the polling. So I don't pay a lot of, and truthfully, I don't pay a lot of attention to polls. What we're focused on is doing the best job we can for as long as we possibly can, pushing this campaign off as long as we can so we can pass good policy in Washington, D.C. And then hopefully the people of the state of Montana will see that, understand that, and we'll have done a good job getting our message out in the process. And we'll be fine on election day. But, you know, if it doesn't turn out that way and we don't do the things we need to do to, and I don't end up going back, I mean, I've always been a farmer and I'll always be a farmer, and that's it. That'll be my full-time job then. So we're going to do the best we can do. We think we've done a great job. I think I've done a great job. We don't crow about it near as much as we probably should have, but we're going to have to let people know what we've done, and we're going to.
What's the best way for the average citizen to give you their thoughts?
Oh.
How are the average folks heard?
Oh, yeah. Great question. I've got 8 offices in the state of Montana. More than welcome to come into any of those offices at any point in time. Talk to the staff members that are there about issues of concern. We get 300 to 500 contacts a day, whether it's emails, letters, or phone calls. That's all my offices, including the one in Washington, D.C. That is very effective. The Postal Service will hate me for this, but I don't encourage folks to use letters if it's time sensitive, because it takes a long time to get through the process back in Washington, D.C., the radiation and all that stuff, because of what happened a few years back. But emails are good, phone calls are good, and if it's not time-sensitive information, the mail's good. I mean, as long as you don't expect us to, you know, we try to respond to every email that comes out of Montana and every phone call, for sure, and some of the ones that don't, too. But that's the best way. That really is the best way. Mm-hmm. Go to the office, give us a call, shoot us an email, or write us a letter.
It seems to me that campaigns may be easily swayed by certain groups because of email and the immediacy of email. So you come to town, and you're having a meeting on, I don't know, the Forest Jobs Act, and all of a sudden the environmentalists and all the people who are against the bill mm-hmm. get 60 people to come, and there's only 3 people who are not part of those groups.
Mm-hmm.
How do you measure that? You've got 60 people speaking on one side of an issue, but there's 3 people who are just as
important. It's one of the reasons I come back to state every weekend. I mean, you're always, we're always talking to folks. My staff is always talking to folks, and I think we're able to get a pretty good sense. And the other thing is that some of you just got to make the call. I mean, sometimes you got to go with your gut, what's best.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, things don't happen real quickly in Washington, D.C. You may have noticed that. And so there's plenty of time to get information. There really is. That really isn't the problem. And you're right. Situations like that happen, although they don't happen a lot. They do happen like that. But the next week it may be the other side that's got organized and come back. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it's a process.
Any other questions?
I had a quick one. Regardless of what happens in November, you're going to be there for almost a year. Do you have any legislative initiatives planned for this coming year?
Yeah, I do. I'll just touch on a couple of them. I still got some stuff with veterans. I'll give you one of them, for example. PTSD, TBI is the signature injury coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan. You guys know that.
PTSD, and what's TBI?
TBI, traumatic brain injury.
Oh.
It's same, mental health. I think that vet centers work really, really well, and we were able. I was able to get a vet center in Great Falls and Kalispell to go with the ones in Billings and Missoula. But mileage reimbursement doesn't happen for those vet centers, and I think that could be a real positive because we don't have enough healthcare professionals in Montana, and particularly not in eastern Montana. So I think that could be a big help. When I have veterans sessions and roundtables around the state of Montana. We always hear from veterans who need help that haven't got it yet. So we've made great advances, but that's one thing. Making sure Guard and reservists get the same benefits of active military that have served, I think that's important too, and that's going to be another initiative we'll take up. I've got an initiative that I'm working with Pat Toomey out of Pennsylvania with on access to capital for startup companies, particularly tech companies. It's called Regulation A, and I could get into weeds on that if you want, but it's basically
private sector money?
Yeah.
And how would you leverage that?
Basically, the SEC has rules set up that are antiquated. Now, they've had the ability to change those rules, and they never have. We're just as in the Forest Jobs Act, asking the Forest Service to do something different. We're asking the SEC to change their rules and make it a little more user-friendly for tech startup businesses, which is where, by the way, a fair number of job creation potential is. And, you know, that being from Bozeman, I mean, it's a real possibility. we're going to continue to look for potential jobs bills like the Forest Jobs and Recreation Act and push that through. We're going to continue to work with folks trying to get some sort of policy to deal with the deficit and debt as we move forward. If you take a look at the five committees I sat on, which are Indian Affairs, Veterans Affairs, Banking, Homeland Security, and Appropriation, you know, we're working right now to get money for the water projects in North Central and Northeastern Montana. Critical infrastructure projects we're going to continue to try to get, whether it's a bypass out here at Belgrade or whether it's a Kalispell bypass, Custer Interchange, or water projects, transmission projects, whatever it might be. And then in the area of Homeland Security, you know, the northern border, the low-level radar stuff, we're still going to be advocating hard for that. And quite honestly, the building of the research center in Kansas, I think, is a big mistake, and we've been fighting it for 4 or 5 years. Where they're going to
research
it? It's for animal diseases. It's based off of Plum Island in New York. It's not even on shore facility. They want to move it on shore. And they make some good arguments. And they think they get better researchers, and it's antiquated, so there's going to have to be an investment made in Plum Island. The problem is they're putting this research center. We're going to be dealing with some very, very diseases that can be spread very quickly in the middle of Tornado Alley, in the heart of the country. And our food security is more important than that. I've been trying to visit with them about it. It's one of these things where I don't think there's a real understanding where food comes from and understanding of rural America. And I think it could have some, and in fact, the studies that have come back said it's not that they're a release is likely, let's just put it that way. And so those are just a few things we've been touching on. But I think if you look at the committees I serve on, those five committees, that's really where, you know, we passed a lot of good legislation as it revolved around Indian Country, making sure that legislation gets implemented a way that it does what the legislative intent was, whether it's safety or health care, whatever it might be. I think that, you know, we had Tribal Law and Order Act and Indian Health Care Improvement Act, those things need to be implemented in a way that works on the ground. And so that oversight's important too.
Thanks for taking your time to be here, Senator. I appreciate it.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you, guys. I appreciate you taking time, especially the private sector folks. You're all private sector, but I mean, there's private sector folks. But I very much appreciate the opportunity to visit with you. It's always enlightening for me too. So thank you.
Thank you.